Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Non-lethal chemical warfare may be an oxymoron to some, but actually was the goal of a United States Army research program in the 1960s and 1970s at an Army arsenal in Maryland. The research goal was to find incapacitating non-lethal chemical weapons that would cause the enemy to lie down, smile, and laugh. The research team was led by a psychiatrist, Dr. James S. Ketchum, then a colonel in the United States Army. He attempted to determine if LSD, cannabis, and/or belladonna could achieve the goal of their research program into non-lethal chemical weapons. Dr. Ketchum, the author of Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten, visited the studios of Radio Curious on August 1st, 2008, where we began our interview when I asked him what originally drew him to participate in the project at the Edgewood Arsenal to determine and seek out non-lethal chemical warfare weapons.
I guess it was more or less fortuitous that I took that assignment. I was completing my residency at Walter Reed Army Hospital. I had joined the regular Army primarily for financial incentives initially, but after I was there a while, I decided I liked it. And as I was completing my residency, Dr. Riok, who was the head of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, asked me to come to his office and told me there was a little difficulty going on at Edgewood with one of the subjects. And they didn't have a psychiatrist up there. Because of this little problem, he thought they needed a psychiatrist and I would be just the one for the job. And he had a way about him that was very persuasive, so I accepted, and I wasn't sorry I did so.
Did they tell you what the problem was?
Yes, they had done a few studies with PCP, actually, and five civilian workers there volunteered to take it, and one of them kind of freaked out and got paranoid and had to go in the hospital for 6 weeks. He was okay, but that was not a good outcome.
And this is the same government that was trying to see the value of LSD in warfare as well as marijuana, and now prohibits the use of both of them.
Well, it was before the government got interested. I'm giving this as kind of a background, a shady background to admit. But General Creasy, Major General Creasy, who was the head of the Chemical Corps, heard about LSD, read about it, and thought to himself, well, this is a wonderful drug. We could give this perhaps to people in a small city like San Francisco, no surprise. And by drifting a cloud down over them, they would all become temporarily incapacitated. And if we had a military mission to perform, we could go in and do it without killing anyone, come back out. People would come too, go back to their daily routine, and everything would be fine and no deaths, and be a wonderful victory for the Chemical Corps and the Army. And Congress was intrigued by his presentation. As a matter of fact, out of the entire Congress of about 435, everyone with one dissent voted to triple the Chemical Corps budget and approve the further testing of LSD as a possible non-lethal agent.
What was the nature of the program that the funding was to underwrite?
Well, it was just a rudimentary program to begin with. As I mentioned, the people who took PCP were civilian volunteers, but they got approval to recruit enlisted men, voluntarily, of course, and starting out with maybe 20 every 2 months, gradually increased to 40. And by the time I got there, the program was well underway. But an interesting thing had happened. LSD had already shown itself not to be the drug of choice. It had complications in that people would sometimes do unpredictable things or have bad trips, and especially when given covertly, which I think was an unfortunate decision on the part of the doctor who was running the Army program at that time. He did a little covert work himself with volunteers. I did not approve of that. When I got there, that ended. However, it came back to haunt him and the Chemical Corps later when the whole situation was investigated in 1975. So when I got there, I initially was just a research psychiatrist. He was my first boss.
And this was in?
1961, February. And so I first observed. There were some other doctors who had been drafted. We were still back in the draft in those days. There were five doctors already there. They were mostly just finishing internship and not gone on to specialization yet.
Well, tell us about the research that was conducted. You were the supervisor.
Well, I didn't start out as the supervisor, but I kind of imposed myself a bit as a supervisor. And gradually I set up a separate unit, or was given space for a separate unit, to do psychopharmacology studies, because the Chemical Corps was interested not only in the new non-lethal weapons, but of course in lethal weaponry as well. That had been well established. But the nerve agent studies were continuing, even as we shifted most of our emphasis to the incapacitating or non-lethal agents. The research with the lethal agents was, at that point, mostly confined to finding antidotes and how to deliver them, what dose of, say, GB or sarin would require to lower the blood cholinesterase level, which is an indicator of the chemical aspects. And that work went on and continues to go on even today, finding defenses. We were supposed to be doing a defensive research operation, but everyone knew that whatever we learned was bound to be looked upon as a potential offensive weapon, even if not for first use.
So, what kinds of things did you learn?
Well, when I arrived, testing with BZ, which I'll discuss later, hadn't really gone very far. There'd been a few subjects tested on low doses. But there was still some interest in LSD, and there was still some interest in a derivative of tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient of marijuana. And it's a long-acting, more potent version of marijuana, which conceivably could be used in the dosage necessary because it was so potent. So I did a little work with that, and we tested, but we realized this wasn't going to be a very practical, non-lethal agent. And because BZ was now a hot drug, we started to do systematic testing with BZ.
What is BZ?
Well, it's 3-quinuclinidyl benzylate.
And that comes from the belladonna mushroom?
Well, not directly. It's a synthetic, but it is very well closely related to atropine and scopolamine, drugs that have been used for centuries. But BZ turned out to be about 20 times as potent as atropine and lasted about 20 times as long, which meant that a half a milligram would do the job of 10 or 12 milligrams of atropine. And we found that the effective dose 50, as they referred to it, ED50, which would be enough to incapacitate 50% of the population on average. And that was a very practical low dose that possibly could be used in the field.
When you say incapacitating, what would be the physical effects on an average person?
Well, that was one of the things we had to define operationally in terms that could be described objectively and other people could replicate. And we defined it as falling below 10% on a particular battery of cognitive or mental testing, such as number facility, ability to add simple numbers or circle words in a matrix of random letters. And so an individual who dropped below 10% at some point after being given BZ would be considered incapacitated. This effect then would last for usually 2 to 3 days, from after which the individual would have a lengthy sleep as a rule and recover feeling quite well and able to perform normally again. lot of people think of that as a horrible experience. Actually, the subjects didn't remember much of it because when you're delirious, you tend to not remember much of what had happened. And so they, one individual said when he woke up, gee, you know, if I didn't know better, I'd say it was probably Sunday rather than Friday, the dose, the day he'd received it. And, of course, it was Sunday, and he was rather surprised to hear that. So there's a pretty complete amnesia. And as a result, some of the subjects were, after we asked, willing to do it again as a second dose to compare in a crossover design with those who got treated, let's say two at a time. One would receive treatment, the other none, and then the 2 weeks later they would reverse positions, and the other one would receive treatment.
And again, what was the chemical that was distributed?
Well, BZ was the chemical. The treatment that was given was physostigmine, which we did not discover right away.
In terms of the testing of tetrahydrocannabinols, what did you find out?
There had been some early work with THC itself and also with a concentrated elixir, you might call it, called red oil. It was an extract that was more potent, more in the range of hashish in potency. And that was quite effective, but again, not strong enough to be considered useful.
When you say effective, what do you mean?
Effective in terms of causing incapacitation at a predictable dose.
What kind of incapacitation? Lying around, unable to move, and lack cognition?
Well, it would vary depending on the drug. With THC, the most obvious early effect that would be considered incapacitation was a drop in blood pressure, which would require lying down to maintain consciousness. And when the drug was later divided into its eight stereoisomers, EA-2233 is what I'm speaking of, that was accomplished in around 1965, and the individual isomers were thought or hoped to be more effective than the mixture. It turned out that there were two isomers that were quite effective, but the effectiveness was expressed mainly in the effect on blood pressure. And when individuals began to complain they couldn't stand up without getting dizzy and had to lie down, Dr. Seidel, who was running the test, thought it best to discontinue it. We didn't want people to get adverse effects due to low blood pressure, for example. I think we were very, very conscientious in that regard, by the way, because we stopped doing tests that outside institutions continue to use. So incapacitation in that sense would be inability to stand. The general definition of incapacitation would be a temporary loss of ability to perform as a soldier, the sense that a commanding officer would consider an individual unable to carry out his duties.
And that was the goal, to produce enemy.
Yes, to produce incapacitation without producing death. And that, of course, meant we had to know what kind of safety margin we were dealing with, which turned out to be an interesting process.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, I can. I had an assistant who was a very brilliant psychologist. I asked him if he would review the literature on atropine, the older literature. And he went to the Library of Congress and he searched volumes of medical publications going back for 100 years and dug out several hundred articles dealing with accidental poisoning with atropine and deaths or survivals resulting from different doses. And he found that the average dose needed to cause death with atropine was about 450 milligrams. Well, we used that then as our standard estimate of lethality because we knew that atropine at a dose of 10 to 12 would produce incapacitation or delirium, but it would take about 40 times as much to cause death in the average case. And we thought that was a pretty good safety margin.
Let's talk about these drugs in the current society now. There was a time during the height of the Haight-Ashbury where you worked as a physician at the Free Clinic. You mention in your book that to some extent, beginning then and up through the present time, that you have developed a personal appreciation for the effects of marijuana. And many people in the United States have developed that same appreciation, and it's become a major economic portion of the economy here in Mendocino County and in other Northern California counties, as well as I'm sure many other states. Yet the governments are afraid or don't recognize it. So my question is, with your medical experience and your observation for well over 40 years, why is this? What is your analysis?
Well, it's a difficult thing to say, but it's a longstanding opposition to the use of drugs that are considered recreational drugs. It also had political underpinnings because there were no restrictions on the use of heroin, morphine, cocaine, marijuana. These are all sold in patent medicines, or they could be prescribed. Until the early 1900s, that time the railroad to the West was still in progress, and many Chinese workers were part of that crew, and they had a kind of an ethnic preference for opium. And this was thought to be a bad thing, that it would spread to others and we'd soon have an opium epidemic. So that became outlawed, in effect, by the Harrison Act. And then it turned out that that wasn't the only problem. We had a lot of Mexicans working in this country who preferred marijuana, and so that was looked upon as a public health menace, and that was outlawed by passing an act requiring doctors to have a special expensive stamp to prescribe it and really cut down on its distribution. With cocaine, that was seen in the black community, and that was also proscribed. So we ended up with three major drugs that were forbidden. And since then, we've also included the psychedelic drugs such as LSD and a number of other related drugs, which are also claimed to be very harmful. Now, I think this is crazy. There have been several commissions over the years, starting in the 19th century, with the Hemp Commission in Great Britain, which did a careful study of the effects of marijuana and concluded that there were no serious problems there, no reason to make it illegal. But this was ignored by the government, so I guess they have the same prejudices over in England that we have here, kind of a puritanical notion or fear that people will somehow get benefits or have effects that
Perhaps they shouldn't have.
That they shouldn't have, yes.
From other people's points of view on how the society at large should behave.
Right, and of course you know about the struggle to have alcohol prohibited. That went on with great fervor until finally it was made illegal. And after 14 years, the crime rate in Chicago and elsewhere, the killings, the illegal manufacture of alcohol beverages that in some cases were even poisonous, began to be obvious, and it would look like it really wouldn't be very worthwhile to continue this and have all this spread of crime and personal injury. So it was repealed in 1933, I believe, and thereafter became an acceptable drug, even though, of course, as we know, alcohol is one of the two major causes of death in the United States, the other being tobacco, and neither one has been proscribed or made forbidden. Seems rather ironic.
Well, let's talk, if we may, about the different effects, cancer-causing effects, on the human body between smoking marijuana and smoking tobacco.
Well, very obviously, smoking tobacco leads to thousands of unnecessary deaths from lung cancer annually, whereas there's never been a known death considered to be directly related to the use of marijuana, which is quite remarkable.
No issue of developing of lung cancer, as tobacco seems to do?
There was some fear that it might for a while, and a couple of researchers thought maybe it did have some likelihood of doing that. It was compared to cigarettes in the sense that one marijuana cigarette would be equivalent to a pack of cigarettes. Well, the individual who pushed this notion most ardently has in the last few years withdrawn his opposition and realized that the data they had really didn't support that point of view.
Well, what prompted you to write your book, Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten?
Well, that's interesting. The work we did at that time was mostly considered classified. Very rarely was it considered secret. And after a period of 12 years, as a general rule, those reports were declassified and technically available to those in the public who requested them. If they couldn't get them easily, they could go through the Freedom of Information Act and almost always could get them. But over the last few years, that policy has tightened up considerably, and it's now almost impossible for even the very concerned agencies in this field to get reports out of the government.
Why do you feel this change in policy came about?
Well, I have to say, rather paranoid disposition on the part of the administration.
That's the Bush administration.
Well, yes, and I have to say Clinton administration just as well. They haven't really differed in their overall policy of being rather secretive and keeping information behind closed doors.
Do you have some thoughts as to why they have this paranoid policy and what their concerns are?
I think it's a general tendency of most governments to keep secrets to themselves wherever possible.
But why are they selecting these secrets, the uses of marijuana, for instance, which has a significantly less social harmful aspect than alcohol or tobacco, pursuant to what you were saying a few moments ago?
Well, I think having adopted the policy of keeping these drugs out of the hands of, quote, children or other people who might do bad things.
But why would that policy be directed towards marijuana and not tobacco or alcohol?
Well, tobacco and alcohol had already proven they couldn't be stopped. The companies that were making them, the distributors, etc.
When do you think that the recognition that the paradigm of the general population's or the percentage of the population's use of marijuana will be recognized as having changed?
Well, I'm hoping very soon. I hear that Barney Frank has introduced a bill into Congress, the first one designed to make possession of small amounts of marijuana for personal use not a crime, and I'm certainly fully in agreement with that. There are a number of polls that show the vast majority of the American citizens, in spite of the propaganda they've been fed, do believe that marijuana is a relatively safe drug and should be legalized. But as you know, our government doesn't always follow the results of polls.
Well, let's go back then and finish your answer as to what prompted you to write your book, Chemical Warfare, Secrets Almost Forgotten.
Okay. As I mentioned, the declassification of most of our reports, and there were many because we had over 60 physicians working in that program in the 10-year period that I was involved. And many reports were generated of scientific usefulness, but those were classified and not declassified until 12, in some cases later. BZ, I think, was not declassified for almost 20 years. So the public didn't get to see them. The doctors who did the work were draftees. They went back to their practices, soon put Edgewood behind them. And only one stayed on, Fred Seidel, who did stay on for another 35 years as a civilian physician, and he taught the treatment of nerve gas injuries. But by and large, those reports were left in file drawers and basically not referred to, not talked about. No one undertook to write an overall global reconstruction of what was done during that decade. I've been told by one of the historians in the Army who found my book interesting, and by the way, it's been well received by the Army as well as the counterculture, and even by people in central government, FBI, they all like the book. But my point is that those reports really were growing covered with dust, lying in file cabinets. Many people didn't know that such experiments had ever taken place, even people within the Army. One individual wrote to me and he said he asked his commanding officer, who was a colonel, what about those studies that were done at Edgewood with drugs back in the 60s? He said there were no such studies, which is really rather remarkable.
You think he was lying or just ignorant?
I think he's probably ignorant because he had heard nothing about them, and so if you don't know anything about it, it doesn't exist in the minds of some people. But anyway, this information was still sitting there. I thought it had scientific merit. It might even have a military merit in that we had gone a long way toward finding a suitable incapacitating agent. And probably with the modern technology that's available, it could be used in certain battle situations, limited in number, of course, but in some. I felt that information should be brought out. Number two, after the 9/11 attack, the public fear of chemical warfare rose sharply, and chemical warfare was placed in the same category as biological and nuclear warfare, which I feel is an inappropriate grouping. It's rather like putting marijuana in the same category with cocaine and morphine.
Well, Dr. Jim Ketchum, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have a couple of questions
sure.
that I like to ask at this time of every program. And one is, can you tell us about an important concept or idea that you've learned recently?
Well, I was thinking about that on the way over. And what I've come to believe is that the best hope for mankind has got to be the scientific community, because our social community is falling apart at the seams, and yet great progress is being made in science, in treating diseases, in communication, in materials. In fact, all these fields are working together to produce some remarkable products, and I think if there's going to be a solution to our social problems, it's got to come from the scientists. But I think that's the number one thing I've come to believe.
Well, finally, Dr. Jim Ketchum, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
I certainly would recommend that people take a look at the two main books that Anne and Sasha Shulgin have written. The first one was called Pikhal, P-I-K-H-A-L, which is idiosyncratically named that to stand for Psychedelics I Have Known and Loved. Phenylethylamines I've known and loved. And then they wrote a second book called Tikal, which is tryptamines I've known and loved. These two categories of drugs comprise what is probably the bulk of psychedelic or mind-altering drugs at the present time.
Well, Dr. Jim Ketchum, I want to thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, it's been a great experience. You asked some good questions.
Thank you. Dr. James Ketchum is a retired Army colonel and the director of a U.S. Army research program in the 1960s and 70s with the goal of establishing non-lethal chemical warfare weapons that would cause the enemy to lie down, smile, and laugh. The books he recommends are Pikhal, A Chemical Love Story, and Tikal, The Continuation, both by Alexander and Anne Shulgin. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org.
There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.